Welcome into the Karen Conti podcast. It's a very special edition tonight, and we have a very special guest. Thank you for joining me. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the release of the movie Presumed Innocent. Remember that movie with Harrison Ford and Brian Dennehy, Raul Julia? And it's based upon what I consider the best legal novel of all time, and many other people join me in that opinion. Chicago native son Scott Turow has authored this book and has gone on to author 14 books, 10 bestsellers. He's sold 30 million books, translated into 40 languages, and he's with us tonight to talk. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Nice to talk to you again. How is everything?
Good? Everything is good, and it's nice to hear your voice. It would be better to see you, but we're not quite there yet.
In that era.
No. It's a whole new world since we last spoke.
We're in our alternate universe. It will end. I'm hoping for spring of 2021 for life to begin to zoom back to normal.
You're very optimistic, and I hope you're right. So let's talk. You have a new book. It's called Last Trial. It was on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's a very interesting book. I've read it cover to cover, and I want to talk a little bit about it in light of the fact that I think in some ways it's prophetic. It was prophetic because it has to deal a little bit with some of the current issues that are going on. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the basis of the book?
So the novel's central character is Sandy Stern, who was the defense lawyer in Presumed Innocent. In the movie, he was played by Raul Julia. And Sandy is now 85 years old at the end of his legal career, but he's called back into combat, as it were, one more time in order to defend an old friend of his, a fellow Argentine immigrant named Kirill Pafko, who, among other things, is the former Nobel Prize winner in medicine. And Kirill is in hot water because he has successfully brought to market a seemingly very effective anti-cancer medication that, unfortunately, has the side effect of occasionally killing the people who take it, something that Kirill supposedly knew about, and did not inform the government, the FDA, about when the drug was approved. So that is the setup. And I think, of course, when you're talking about the prescience of the book, it does give, I hope, a entertaining version of the complications of the clinical trial process by which exciting new drugs go through the accelerated approval process that the drug in the novel called Gilivia, and that obviously our COVID vaccines are going to receive. And if you want to know what the problem is, the novel documents what can go wrong with the fast track approval.
Well, it doesn't make you just want to jump out and get a COVID vaccine.
It does not.
So let's go back. So the title is a double entendre because Sandy Stern is now 85. I presume this is his last trial, thus the name of the book. But it's also about the trials of the FDA trials as well. So it's kind of an interesting interplay because this is kind of his last hurrah. At 85, he's trying his case and he's still doing a great job, still commanding the courtroom. Scott, I was walking in today and one of the longtime news guys asked me what I was doing. I told him I'm interviewing Scott Turow, and he's like, Sandy Stern, is he in the book? Is he in the book? Is it still in Kendall County? And it hit me that Kendall County, I'm sure it's hit you, that fictional courtroom, that fictional place has now named after a reading device.
Yeah, well, I don't think that the people at Amazon admit that, but the fellow who was the head of the Kindle reading program is a native Chicagoan and is, I have been told, a fan of my work. So,
so it may be that
that's a coincidence or a tiny bit of an homage. The joke, of course, is that as the president of the Authors Guild, I was constantly at odds with Amazon, not because I don't think it's a great company. It is not because I don't think they've built a better mousetrap. They have. But I think the way they gained market share, particularly when it comes to ebooks, was a little on the treacherous side. And certainly under the antitrust laws that I learned when I went to law school, they probably breached them. Now that the antitrust laws have moved on, so if that reading device had was any kind of a minor homage to me, I'm sure that they all regret it now.
They got theirs. So let's talk a little bit about some of the, you know, in your book, Scott, one of the things that I try to do on my show is to educate people about the legal system, but also entertain, mm-hmm. because nobody wants to listen to radio or read a book when they're not entertained, where they're not turning pages and they are engaged with the characters. And certainly your characters are wonderful. But what you do is, I call it like painlessly educating the readers. Tell us... what you think about it. So this issue of FDA approval, you tell us how it works. And I assume you had to do some serious research on the nature of how this works. How did you do that?
Very serious research. One of the sort of untold pieces of assistance that I got is I have a daughter who is a pharma lawyer. And, you know, she's, I didn't want to credit her with anything because I didn't want her to get blamed for some of the things I say about either the FDA, where she once worked and where she still has many, many friends, you know, or about the industry or anything like that. But, and, you know, it really, it bears saying that the opinions expressed are strictly my own. But obviously listening to Rachel over the years, I had pretty good insight into the world of pharmaceuticals. So, you know, that was my start. And it is such, I really think, Karen, and I say this to you as another law-educated person, I think it's the most complicated body of law that I have ever had to deal with. Hmm. And, you know, the last novel before this one was about the International Criminal Court in The Hague. That was not even a heavy lift compared to trying to understand the body of law that guides clinical trials. And the reality is that there is so much money to be made in pharmaceuticals. It's a large share of our economy that. You know, the drug companies fight and scrap and lobby and protest over every regulation, every rule, every interpretation. And so it becomes so minute as to each rule and what it means and what exactly you're supposed to do. And it didn't take me very long to realize that, you know, well, this regulation over here and that regulation over there are completely contradictory. and I have no damn idea what a lawyer who's advising a client in that area would tell him to do. And that's why ultimately I just said, okay, I'm going to explain the broad outline of this and not worry about how complicated and often self-contradictory this body of law is.
You know, we are obviously going through this horrible COVID thing, and there's all this talk about, do we believe science? Is science believable? Should we rely on science? There are certain people who aren't relying on science and going with their gut, who shall be remain nameless. But If you came down on one side or the other of the FDA, do they do a good job? Do they move too quickly in the process, according to what you have seen? Or do you think they move too slowly and stop drugs from going on the market that might actually help people? Do you have an opinion on that, just doing the research that you've done?
Well, first of all, I regard the FDA as peopled by a lot of very loyal public servants. Things move slowly there because they are often fought to a standstill. by the pharmaceutical industry, which, of course, opposes new regulations. And at the same time, if they stand to make money, you know, they're trying to light a fire under the regulators. And I don't know this for a fact, but my sense from the outside is occasionally inside the agency, there's almost a defeatist attitude that they're going to encounter so much resistance that, well, let's go home and we'll start again tomorrow. But overall, the people at the FDA only mean to do well by the American people. And again, you can look at the fictional problem that's posed in the last trial and say, okay, here is a medication that has a remarkable track record in treating non-small cell lung cancer. But would the FDA have approved it knowing that, say, 1 in 100 people who take it are going to die of an allergic reaction? And the answer is probably yes. Probably yes. But that is a decision that each patient and each physician should be allowed to make for themselves. That's why you sign, you know, all of these waivers whenever you're having a medical procedure. And so, you know, you're dealing with not just science, but also notions of informed consent. And it is a very it's a very complicated, you know, set of facts as a result.
Going back to the characters in your book, and they're complicated, and that's always good to have complicated characters. Sandy Stern, we've watched through some peripheral as a peripheral character and some as a central right. character. And this might be his last trial. Well, the name of the book is The Last Trial. So he's 85 years old. And is it sad to see him do his final hurrah here? He seems like he's doing well, maybe not physically, but mentally. He's still got it going, and he's still giving the impact passionate arguments that he has made in the past. Is it sad to say goodbye to such a trusted and loyal character of yours?
You know, I don't feel sad personally about getting older. You know, I'm chugging up towards 72 now. And, you know, in many ways, it's the best time in my life. I know that it's not going to remain that way. But, you know, Stern is not somebody who feels in the end that he's wasted his life. He's made mistakes. He's had, you know, complications in his marriages. He had one not so great marriage and a second very, very good marriage. And, you know, he's got a child he doesn't get along with. And, so his life isn't perfect, but he's led what, by his own lights, is a worthwhile life. And, you know, his attitude toward his career is my attitude toward his career. And, you know, I felt good as a lawyer being able to say, you know, to the many people who are skeptical about our profession, you know, you can do a lot of good in this field. You may not, you know, change the course of history. You know, and Stern thinks about that at the end, that his Nobel Prize winning client is much far more likely to be remembered, you know, 500 years from now than Sandy Stern is. But, you know, he's helped a lot of people along the way. Not necessarily getting, you know, guilty clients off the hook. It happens now and then. But he's given them good advice and helped them ease their passage through the justice system. And so I feel good for Stern. I feel good for me. And, you know, I never felt like I was actually parting company with Sandy. If I miss him too much, you know, I can always take him backward in time.
That's right. And, there's always, you know, the prequel.
Right. So I didn't, feel like I was absolutely signing his death warrant. And we'll see how that works out. I certainly don't, as I sit here today, have any intentions about writing another book in which Sandy is the main character. But, you know, never say never. Things can happen.
Roger Ebert said about presumed innocent, presumed innocent has as its core one of the most fundamental fears of civilized man, the fear of being found guilty of a crime one did not commit. Mm-hmm. That fear is at the heart of more than half of Hitchcock's films, and it is one reason they work for all kinds of audiences. Everybody knows that fear. Mm-hmm. And you know, presumed innocent is the example, the great example of that. Is that something that you consciously thought about when you wrote the book?
No, I was, as you know, a young prosecutor here in Chicago, and I was just trying to write about what I knew. I had spent 5 years out at the Creative Writing Center at Stanford as a writing fellow and then as a lecturer in the English department. And I had all kinds of very highfalutin theoretical attitudes toward writing fiction. And wasn't meeting with a lot of success. And finally, I just said, well, I'm going to take the approach that people take in the courtroom, which is just try to tell a good story. And, I wasn't thinking about the particulars of being wrongfully accused, which, of course, has been, you know, as it happens, a major theme in my and many other lawyers' professional lives. I just wanted to provide entree into this world where I thought people were very gripped by the fundamental questions that are at the heart of every criminal case, which is, you know, did she or he, did they do it? If they did do it, why in the world would they do something that their community regards as so wrong? When it turns out, after about a third of the book, that Rusty Savage is accused of the murder that he was investigating, as I was in the long, fitful stage of doing a, you know, first draft of the book, it took years. When Rusty ended up being accused, I was as surprised as any reader in the novel has been since.
You're surprised by what your characters are doing and what's happening.
Yeah. So I remember I took at least a year off from writing the book. I was writing on the morning commuter train on the old Chicago Northwestern, now the Union Pacific. And I remember there was a moment when Raymond Horgan, Rusty's boss, ends up handing Rusty a missing piece of evidence. And I'm like, how the hell did that get in Raymond's drawer? This is, I said, I better stop and get a grip on this story. And I did. I just sort of fought my way through the rest of it. So.
You know, people are, I guess I'm amazed that people are so fascinated by the legal system. I think, in my view, I see like post-OJ, or maybe it was the fact that trials are now being broadcast and we're watching these trials rather than hearing about them from reporters. And people are just fascinated. I mean, people that tune into my show are constantly, you know, curious about how things work, and they have questions about news stories that they hear. They want to explain. They like the power of knowing how the legal system works. But let me ask you, do you think that people put too much faith into our system? Or do you think that there's been kind of a falling out and maybe people are distrusting our system more these days?
Well, they certainly get disappointed in lawyers. I think, first of all, the late Joseph Toro, very, very fine district court, U.S. district court judge in Boston. I remember I was his one of his former law clerks is a close friend of mine, and we were sitting with the judge, and he looked at me and he says, you know, he says, it's a really good day when only half the people who've been in my courtroom leave unhappy. Because because very often it's higher than that. Even the people who supposedly won their motions or their summary judgment motion, whatever it is, even they leave unhappy because they think, I didn't understand them, or they should have won more than they won.
Or it costs too much to pay my lawyer to do it.
Well, that's for sure. That is for sure. And the people expect perfect justice. And without understanding that our system, when it operates well, will generate a range of outcomes that a lawyer will tell you are reasonable under the circumstances. Typical criminal case. If the evidence is overwhelming, yeah, the defendant should be found guilty. But if it's less than overwhelming, you would look at it and go, 80% of the time the defendant's going to be found guilty, 20% of the time he's going to be found not guilty, and walk out of the courtroom free. And Americans say, he did it. He did it. Why should he be released? Why should he have his freedom? But that is the system we have. We believe that before you deprive a human being of his or her liberty, they should be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And sometimes the government can't do it. And it is not a statement of moral vindication when somebody is found not guilty of a crime. It is, as Sandy Sturm says near the end of the last trial, it's simply our way of saying as a society, I don't know. I don't know if he did it. I mean, maybe he did it, but I'm not sure. And that's very frustrating to lay people.
I guess when I hear people on my show call me and they have issues and I tell them, you can't resolve this through the courts. It's too expensive. It's not worth it to pay a lawyer to handle this, or there's no avenue to get this done in a way that's going to resolve your issue. People are hugely disappointed. So I guess I feel too that people are, they put our system on such a pedestal, which makes me feel good because we have such a great system and it has so much respect, not only here but around the world, but it doesn't always work the way people think it should. In your books, you always have different twists and different facts, and nothing ever works out perfectly, nor are your characters perfect. So I think that's a good education that they get from your books.
Yeah, and the other great flaw in the system, and the reason it so often deviates from the ideal, is it's a system run by human beings. And nobody has ever met another person without shortcomings. And for example, if you take somebody who's just a normal human being with normal imperfections and you put them on the bench where they wield great power, power is going to magnify the shortcomings in any personality. And, Sandy Sturm is trying the case in the last trial in front of truly an old and dear friend of both him and his daughter. They're the defense lawyers and the prosecutor,
right,
who's across the courtroom. They're all old friends. And yet Sandy sees in this woman he really, truly admires as a judge, he sees that she's become, over her years on the bench, somewhat short-tempered. And he knew when he was younger that, she could be a little, she could fly off the handle. But it didn't dawn on him that as a judge, this really minor defect in her personality would have an impact in the courtroom. And she is really, truly a good judge. But she's a little quicker to anger than she should be. And that's what goes on in the justice system. Really good people trying to do good things. But in situations where their shortcomings are magnified.
Interesting. Let's talk about something not as deep, but interesting, I think, to listeners. And that is, when I read a book, and I almost always read the book before I see the movie, I have really defined expectations of what the characters look like, what they sound like, mm-hmm. especially if it's a good writer. The better the writer, the more I'm mm-hmm. able to actually mm-hmm. visualize and actually feel like I know that person. And I did so much so with Presumed Innocent. Then when I saw the movie, I really thought they did a good job with the characters. Now, as an author, how do you feel when you see this movie, which was a fabulous movie? Did that meet up to your expectations of your characters?
Well, first of all, I thought I was very well served by the movie. I thought Alan Pakula, the director, was a lovely man before his untimely passing in a freak accident on the Long Island Expressway. Alan was trying to make a movie that was very faithful to my vision, and I think he did it. They asked me about almost the sort of the sepiated quality of the light in the courtroom that I wrote about, and they tried to recreate that. But when I saw the very first piece of film from Presumed Innocent, which is, Joe Grisafi confronting Harrison Ford, Joe as Tommy Malto and Harrison as Rusty Savage. They're speaking, they happen to be speaking lines from the novel almost exactly as I wrote them. They're saying them in the way I heard those words uttered. And yet inside me, something shrieked, wait, the camera's on the wrong side of the room. I saw it from the other side of the room. Alan filmed it from, from this side. So nobody is ever going to fully capture what you as a novelist envision. And you have to accept when you turn your book over to Hollywood, and most writers would give their eye teeth for that.
Exactly. Exactly.
You have to accept that you are handing off your work to another artist. And you cannot tell that other artist, that filmmaker, those actors, do it my way completely. Because, first of all, I don't know how to be a director. And second of all, it diminishes them as independent artists to insist that it can only be your vision that guides the project. And I can tell you novelist after novelist who's gotten him or herself in trouble by not being willing to accept the fact that another artist is going to be superimposing his or her vision on your work. You have to accept that to begin with. So is Raul Julia in Presumed Innocent, does he look anything like the Sandy Stern I described? No. Does he have this subtle intelligence and elegance in the courtroom of my Sandy Stern? He sure as hell does. And Raul said to me when I was on the set, he says, I know I'm not your Sandy Stern. And I said to him, Raul, you are my Sandy Stern.
Well, and now he is, because when I read your book, your most recent book, who did I see when Sandy came out, into the courtroom? I saw Raul Julia, and I will always see a Raul Julia, because that's now who Sandy Stern is. So,
I joke, but it's not. I'm not kidding. But 20 years later, I wrote a sequel to Presumed Innocent called Innocent, and when I began writing Innocent, it was hard for me not to see Harrison's face when I was writing about Rusty Savage. And the two of them, by the way, look a good deal alike. And if you go back to the physical descriptions of Rusty and Presumed Innocent, you will see that they're men of the same size, and facial features are very much alike. So it wasn't a big stretch to see Harrison in Rusty's face in Rusty's, but still, It took a long time for him to go transform himself back into my Rusty.
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. We went a little longer than I thought, but I had a lot of questions for you. And I know I took you away from your keyboard, so I'll let you get back to being a writer. And please join me again.
Karen, it's always a privilege. And to you and everybody else out there, don't let your guard down. Stay safe. Stay safe. It's going to be a tough winter. Stay safe.
Agreed. Thank you, Scott Turow.